From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, here's the news for this day in Maine, Thursday, May 26, 2016. I'm Andrew Catalina, in for Barbara Caridi. And on this day, Bruce Poliquin is accused of flip-flopping after voting in favor of an LGBT anti-discrimination amendment. The Maine Department of Health and Human Services is asking SNAP recipients to pay back around $2 million it accidentally overpaid. And MPBN reporter Fred Bever takes a deep dive into Maine's alleged energy crisis. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by Knack Factory, offering video production, photography, and communication strategy. knack-factory.com. And Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of Maine Public Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
U.S. Representative Bruce Poliquin of Maine's 2nd District is being criticized by political rivals for his vote this week on a measure to prohibit federal contractors from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Democrats accuse Poliquin of flip-flopping on the issue after voting against a similar measure last week. Poliquin says he was just trying to protect the rights of religious organizations. Mallory reports.
Poliquin actually voted for a similar amendment last year, aimed at prohibiting federal contractors from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation. But last week, he voted against a new measure, citing the fact that the language in the proposal did not include an exemption for religious groups. Then late Wednesday night, he voted for an amendment opposing discrimination and an amendment providing for the religious exemption.
And we want to make sure that there's no discrimination today against religious organizations, and at the same time, make sure there's absolutely no discrimination against LGBT individuals or anybody else.
But the chairman of the Maine Democratic Party held a news conference outside of Poliquin's Bangor office Thursday to protest his votes on the issue. Phil Bartlett says Poliquin is not telling the truth about changing his vote a week ago.
He tried to pretend that he switched his vote because of religious freedom. It doesn't hold water. He voted for a similar amendment last year, and last night there was no substantive change, and he supported it again. So it's clearly when push comes to shove, Bruce Poliquin can be pushed into complying with leadership.
Poliquin flatly denies that he flip-flopped on the issue, saying he knew he was going to vote against the amendment on the floor last week because it lacked the religious exemption language. Wednesday night, he voted for two amendments that together, he says, provide needed protections for all concerned. He dismisses Bartlett's allegation as, quote, silly season politics.
It's politics. And unfortunately, there are some individuals and some groups, you know, this is the silly season, that want to try to score political points and do it with very, very important issues. There is absolutely no place in our district, in our state, for discrimination.
Bartlett counters that Poliquin is playing politics with an issue that should not be political at all.
He flipped his vote in order to comply with leadership, and then when he got caught, he realized that flip was a flop, he flipped back. It's clearly he was playing politics rather than putting the needs of Maine people first.
Lost in the political charges and countercharges is the fact that the vote ended up being meaningless. The underlying measure to appropriate funding for federal agencies such as Energy and Interior failed on passage. There will likely be further votes on this issue in the months ahead. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
The Maine Department of Health and Human Services has overpaid nearly $2 million in food stamp benefits and now is attempting to collect that money back from over 3,000 elderly and poor Mainers. Steve Missler reports that such payment errors are not uncommon in other states, but the magnitude of this one is rare, and it comes amid the department's effort to radically overhaul the state's welfare system.
DHHS Chief Mary Mayhew and the LePage administration have repeatedly vowed to reform the state's welfare programs. And they've made a lot of changes, reducing the amount of time people can receive benefits, hotly pursuing fraud cases and clashing with the federal government over attempts to put photos on benefit cards. Many of the changes have been politically popular, but at times, implementation has been rocky. That's been true of the department's efforts to automate its application for food stamps, also known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Now, over 3,000 SNAP recipients are receiving letters ordering them to repay the benefits that the state mistakenly gave them. That could pose a hardship for people who, on average, receive a monthly benefit of about $116.
What ends up happening is that their food supplement monthly benefits are reduced by 10%, and when you're getting the bare minimum to start with, and then you're reducing it by 10%, that's very hard to deal with.
That's Jack Comart, the litigation director for Maine Equal Justice Partners, an advocacy group for the poor.
You know, for most of us, if we had to reduce our food budget by 10%, there's enough flexibility. But for poor people living on the bare minimum, that's extremely difficult.
And Comart says that SNAP recipients will have no choice but to pay back the money. The federal government requires it. SNAP is a federal program, but states are responsible for administering it and distributing the funds. In April, more than 230,000 Mainers have received SNAP benefits, totaling more than $21 million, according to federal data. DHHS officials did not respond to a request for an interview, and the department has not specified what caused the error. Comart believes the change in the application system is to blame. Last year, those changes were cited as the reason for slow application processing times that fell well below the federal standard. The feds issued a sternly worded letter to DHHS, ordering the agency to quicken the pace or face a significant loss in federal funding. DHHS Chief Mary Mayhew did not dispute the problem, but she said it stemmed from the department's efforts to modernize its system. Comart doesn't disagree, but he says the processing change is likely driving a surge in overpayments, from 600 2 years ago to 2,200 last year. While overpayments and underpayments are normal for state agencies, the increase in Maine is rare.
The fact that the department was so far behind in processing applications and renewals contributed to the increase in the number of agency error overpayments.
DHHS told the Bangor Daily News that the agency is typically flexible with payment plans unless a recipient has received a court order payment program or has been previously convicted of fraud. If the state doesn't receive payment, a recipient could face garnished Social Security benefits or federal income tax returns. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Governor Paul LePage is continuing to maneuver around state lawmakers to ensure that he keeps his pick for state education chief while avoiding the normal confirmation process. The governor has appointed Deborah Plowman, a former Republican state lawmaker, as temporary deputy education chief. The move essentially allows William Beardsley to perform most of the duties as commissioner, even though Plowman is now, technically speaking, his boss. The new title changes are LePage's latest attempt to keep Beardsley at the helm of the Department of Education. The governor has accused Democrats of conspiring to block Beardsley's appointment. Democrats have countered that LePage is flaunting the rules governing the appointments of commissioners. During a forum on Wednesday, State Representative Victoria Cornfield of Bangor, the lead Democrat on the Education Committee, asked the governor when he planned to formally nominate a commissioner. The two had a testy exchange.
Bill Beardsley is an excellent candidate, an excellent choice, and you folks are just playing games. Excuse me, but that's the truth. Thank you. I answered your question.
After, Cornfield said some lawmakers are concerned that LePage could be violating the law.
I know that some people on the Education Committee are talking to the AG about this, and I know that there are several reports that we are supposed to have gotten by law we have not received. So I think it is a problem that there isn't a commissioner.
LePage has accused Democrats of blocking Beardsley because of his statements on transgender bathroom use. U.S. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who serves on the Senate Appropriations Committee, has been successful in getting funding for another destroyer in the defense budget bill. She says $1 billion was appropriated for the ship last year, and this measure would provide the additional $433 million to build the ship.
If I hadn't been able to get the funding in the bill, in the appropriations process, then we would have virtually no chance of getting the funding.
Collins says the House has yet to consider the defense spending bill, but she expects they will also approve the funding. Her big worry is the case of no bill being passed and instead lawmakers passing another continuing resolution, which would mean new spending like that for the destroyer will not be allowed. Starting June 1st, a group of fishermen will test drive a video monitoring system aboard their vessels designed to take the place of at-sea monitors. At-sea monitors are officials who observe the groundfish catch and oversee what's being thrown back and what's being kept. Ben Martens of the Maine Coast Fishermen's Association says it's not yet clear what the total cost of the video monitoring program will be compared to the cost of having a human actually on board.
In a realistic view, though, having somebody sitting and staring at a computer monitor should be much more cost-effective than having somebody drive to a boat, get onto that boat, sit around on that boat for half the trip while nothing else is taking place.
Martin says at-sea monitors can cost $700 per day. Recently, the cost of paying for those monitors was shifted from the regulatory agency to the fishery itself in an unpopular move. For the fishing year that started May 1st and ending April 30th, 2017, regulators will require at-sea monitoring on 14% of all groundfish trips. Martin says his group has been working with the Nature Conservancy, Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and federal regulators to launch the pilot project, where, similar to a security camera, the catch will be recorded onto a hard drive for review on shore. About 20 volunteers will fish with the video systems to assess its feasibility. The smoking rate among American adults is declining, according to a report released this week by the Centers for Disease Control. In 2015, 15% of U.S. adults were smokers, a 2% reduction from the previous year. Lance Bushy of the American Lung Association of the Northeast says Maine's adult smoking rate is also declining, but trends higher than the national average.
We've been stuck in the 19-20 range, 19 or 20% range for the last couple of years, through 2014 data.
Bushy says Maine's tobacco control funding has declined in recent years and is at about 50% of the recommended level by the CDC. He says one way to reduce that number further is to hike up the tobacco tax.
High prices is one of the best tools to prevent people from smoking.
Bushy says the last time Maine raised the tobacco tax was in 2005. To afford a modest two-bedroom apartment at fair market rates in Maine, typical renters would need to earn just over $17 an hour, and in parts of the state, the so-called housing wage would be much higher. That's according to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition's annual Out of Reach report. Among its findings, the study indicates that the typical renter in Maine earns almost $7 less than the hourly wage needed to afford a modest two-bedroom home. Greg Payne, director of the Maine Affordable Housing Coalition, says the report shows there's what he calls an incredibly difficult mismatch between the housing needed in Maine and what's available.
I think when we get to a point where, you know, in some sections of our state, you know, people have to be working over 100 hours at our minimum wage in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment, I think we have a problem.
Payne says all levels of government need to do a better job at aligning available housing resources with the needs that exist.
Where it puts us is that we need local, state, federal officials to work together to address the issue, to try to create the affordable housing that our seniors need, that our low-income earners need, that folks with disabilities need.
Payne says the figures compiled by the Low-Income Housing Coalition come from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Census. Governor Paul LePage says Maine's single biggest problem is the cost of energy, and compared to the rest of the nation, Maine and New England do struggle with higher prices for electricity. But some observers say prices in the region are trending downward and that there are some important cost drivers that go beyond the simple rules of supply and demand. Fred Bever has the first of two stories on the forces that determine what we pay for the energy we use.
Pretty much any time Governor LePage speaks before a crowd these days, he can be counted on to hammer away at one particular topic.
The energy crisis in Maine, which is, folks, the biggest crisis we face.
LePage recently spoke at the Republican Party convention in Augusta, where he bashed the advocates of alternative energy programs that he says will drive Maine's energy costs even higher.
I have to deal with companies every single day who tell me we can't afford to be in Maine.
While railing against wind and solar, LePage has touted hydropower and expanded natural gas pipeline service to Maine and the region as the solution. But here's the thing. In the past several years, the cost of electricity supply, driven by natural gas, has gone down. And it's a trend noted by LePage's own energy chief, Patrick Woodcock.
Our wholesale pricing is in a much more competitive place than it was 2-3 years ago.
Electricity supply prices in Maine have been sliding steadily downward since highs seen in 2010, although there was a big upward swing in the winter of 2014 that's since abated. For most residential and small business users, supply prices are the lowest they've been since 2005. Industrial rates just awarded for June mark the lowest energy supply rate manufacturers have seen in several years. And while that's just a one-month snapshot, Woodcock says the trend is looking pretty good for the next several years. That's because energy markets are recognizing that new investments in natural gas pipeline technology and capacity in southern New England and Canada will ease supply constraints throughout the region.
Yep, so the constraints in our gas capacity are being relieved, and we're starting to see very, very competitive wholesale and natural gas pricing in the future. And that is a good story to tell for people who are looking to invest in the state, who are existing facilities. We have obviously a lot more to do.
Including more natural gas, says Governor LePage, brought in through new supply lines paid for by consumers. That would hedge against future volatility in gas prices, against the retirement of other cheap power sources in New England, such as the Vermont Yankee and Yankee Pilgrim nuclear plants. And it could help the region compete with other parts of the country that have benefited from their proximity to coal and gas fields or to hydroelectric generators that the federal government subsidized decades ago. And if those pipelines through New England aren't built?
We will not have enough gas, and this is an absolute certainty, to eliminate the price differential between New England and the rest of the country.
Anthony Buxton is a lawyer and lobbyist who represents some of the biggest energy users in the state, mostly paper mills. His view is vehemently opposed by environmentalists who say big investments in new gas infrastructure will only lock the region into over-reliance on the fossil fuel at a time when costs for renewable energy are going down. A recent report by Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories shows that the proportion of an electricity bill in Maine that goes to cover mandated incentives for renewable energy is dropping from more than 1% in 2012 to well less than 1% in 2014. It's a trend state regulators say continued in 2015, even as more renewable energy is added to the mix. Galen Barbos, one of the report's authors, says Maine's renewable energy portfolio costs consumers here less than similar standards in many other states. And he says in any of the 29 states that have such requirements, these incentives play a relatively small role in overall electricity prices.
And in the grand scheme of things, there are just so many other factors that impact both electricity prices as well as just more generally the cost of doing business in any particular state that it's hard to see this one policy really being a driving force between differences across states.
Costs for efficiency measures in Maine have been stable, meanwhile, and put together, the burden of all of Maine's environmentally oriented policies is being more than offset by payments the federal government is making to Maine for past costs of storing nuclear waste from the now-shuttered Maine Yankee plant in Wiscasset. So if the cost of electricity supply and of renewable and efficiency policies in Maine and New England are becoming more competitive with other states, why are the region's overall electric power prices routinely rising 25, 50, and even 100% higher than those in most of the rest of the country? Tim Schneider, the state's public advocate, argues there is one very big factor that doesn't get a lot of public attention in Maine.
The thing that makes our costs beyond supply higher than anywhere in the country is the prices we pay for transmission.
There are historic and structural reasons for that, and some federal and regional policies that states, including Maine, are trying to change. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Thursday, May 26, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to Fred Bever, Mal Leary, Steve Missler, Jennifer Mitchell, Ed Morin, and Patty White for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes or email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Andrew Catalina. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.